Okay, so being the boss of your brain means that you don't accept every thought or feeling or impulse that you have. So for example, let's start with a simple example is, you know, let's say you got, you feel rejected about something and you, and then you start to kind of spiral downwards and, or you're not getting the results that you want. And you think, oh, maybe I should just give up. Or you think, this is so much harder than I thought. Well, when you, with ADHD, you know, you tend not to, be the boss of your brain and you kind of, you let you run with that or you don't challenge it. So by being the boss of your brain, you could say, well, I give myself a lot of credit because I took a risk. I was brave. I was rejected or I didn't get what I wanted, but look at all that I had. And you begin to say, this is not helpful to think that way. And I'm going to, you know, take my brain and forcefully have it think about something else. And I also call that kind of changing the channel. So if you think about, if you are watching cable TV and if you're scrolling through the channels and you see golf and you don't really like golf, you're not going to sit there and watch a golf game. You're going to just change a channel. Mm-hmm. And being the boss of your brain means you can change the channel on your brain. We all have the capacity to do that.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Hey, it's Srini. Before you dig into today's podcast episode, I have a special announcement or invitation. I've put together a two-day in-person event of learning, connection, communication, and collaboration with some of your favorite Unmistakable Creative guests. It's called The Architects of Reality because in 2 days, you'll learn how to purposely design a life you love, find your superpowers, and become the next best version of yourself. The last time we had an event like this, it was 2014, and we have no plans at all to make this an annual event, so it may not happen again until 2024. So this is the time. It's going to take place in April 2020, so that gives you plenty of time to make it happen. But to get on the list, go to unmistakablecreative.com/reality today so you don't miss out. And there's a link in the show notes too. I look forward to seeing your smiling faces in person. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/reality. Now, on with the show.
Laura, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I'm so excited to be here, Srini.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I came across your work because you wrote in and you told me that you're a psychologist who studies attention deficit disorder and does work around managing attention, which is something near and dear to my heart because it's something that I have struggled with for most of my adult life. But before we get into all of that, I want to start by asking you, where in the world did you grow up and what impact did where you grew up end up having on the choices that you've made with your life?
Well, I grew up in the Detroit, Michigan area in a suburb of Detroit, Michigan. And I think that one of the major impacts that had on me because I did end up leaving to come out and ended up in San Francisco was that it in some ways makes me feel grateful every day in the sense of living in a place where there's so much innovation. And, you know, a lot of people have said about San Francisco that it's the place where new ideas meet the least resistance. And so I think that, and even just, you know, thinking about the weather, growing up with, you know, 3 feet of snow for 3 months out of the year, I feel grateful a lot. But I think another thing is that, you know, one of the other aspects of Michigan is that they have so many lakes and I grew up with ponds and lakes. And I think it started out something for me, which, it's just a love of nature and that sort of connection to nature. And so it's something that I seek out. It's something, you know, that's important to me and it fuels, you know, fuels my work. It's something that I am very attentive to spending time in nature probably every day.
Were there early inklings for you of what you wanted to do with your life? And if so, what were they?
Well, I think that when I was in high school, I had to go to see a psychologist. And it's such a fascinating thing that you would who would ever think about wanting to be a psychologist? And how would you really even know about that unless at some point you had maybe gone to see one. And so it, of course, opened my eyes to a career choice that I don't think a lot of people would think about at a young age. And so I actually, even in high school, started, you know, I was strangely thinking I want to be a psychologist. And without actually knowing that much about the field, you know, for example, maybe the person I saw wasn't even a psychologist. Maybe they were an MFT. I wouldn't have known the difference. And so I had a really clear idea about that. And I, you know, started off my education and, you know, pursued it pretty much in a straight line.
So, I mean, from the perspective of a psychologist, why do you think that those kinds of moments are so rare and so many people's careers don't necessarily follow a straight line? You may be the one person I've spoken to that has ever told me that their career path has followed a straight line.
Yeah, I think that it's because we are surrounded by different ideas about what we are supposed to do and whether, you know, so it's approval seeking. And so that could be other people have ideas for us. Other people have ambitions for us. And, you know, some that goes both ways. It can be, you know, I remember a friend who wanted to be a doctor and their parents were working class and they felt like they were betraying, you know, their working class roots. Or it could be that parents are more ambitious for their children or have specific ideas about those careers. And I think also that we don't really do a good job in trying to find out what that very specific talent or interest is. And I like to think of it as the jet stream, which is the thing where it's easy for you, it's fun for you. And I think when we get a message in school that, you know, it's that there, it's about getting good grades and being smarter than other people, it makes it harder for us to figure out, but what do I want to do? And even like in the example that I gave with myself, well, I would have never even heard about a psychologist if I didn't go see one. So how do you find those careers? And so I do think there should be some process of getting as much exposure to as many different ideas of how to earn a living.
As somebody who's a psychologist, how would you redesign the current education system, given your background and your experience?
I think the simplest thing I would say is there has to be two priorities. And one is the love of learning. And that should be a primary goal. And then the second should be to think for yourself. And of course, that is kind of the opposite of the current educational system. And, you know, so one story, you know, one interesting part about my education and interesting thing about the Detroit area is that there's a school there called the Roper School. And it was founded by Anne-Marie Roper, who had escaped from Nazi Germany. And she believed that that the reason that the Holocaust happened was because the Germans were not taught to think for themselves. And so she made it her mission to create a school that those were the main goals, that you think for yourself and that you love learning. And so that I think that that will set people up to figure out what they want to do. You know, I remember, you know, when I went to Roper that they would have other kids that wanted to be, you know, wanted to do theater, and they would write their own plays and they would produce the plays. And I mean, these weren't big productions, but it was really encouraged that you find things that you love and you do more of that.
So I can't help but think about this. I mean, this is something that I've been beating like a dead horse because it's been on my mind, and I'm working on a project about it where, you know, one of the things I've said is one of the greatest lies you're ever told is that you have to choose from the options that are put in front of you, but you have cultural programming that you're actively discouraged from challenging. Like, if I told any of my friends who I went to Berkeley with that working at Goldman Sachs, Thatcher, McKinsey sounded like the worst fucking job in the world, they would have thought I was out of my damn mind because that was the golden standard for what success looked like. So I wonder, as you get older, how do you unwind that inability to think for yourself that gets so programmed into the culture?
Yeah, so I think that that specifically has to be to look at that approval seeking and to kind of question that approval seeking. And, you know, so you can go through and say, well, what would my friends think about this? What would my parents think about this? And then you might want to ask yourself, okay, what do I think about this? And so what am I going to do about these differences between what other people think and what do I think? And another way to kind of dig a little deeper and breaking free from approval seeking is you can ask yourself, when I was 10 years old, what would I have wanted to do with my life? Okay. When I was a teenager, what would I have wanted to do with my life? And then you could think, you know, if I had more confidence, what would I want to do? Because sometimes that can be a barrier. And then 10 years from now, would I still want to be doing this? And so, it's kind of getting this ability to check in with yourself. And a lot of people will have a different answer, like for all of those that, you know, if I thought, what did I want to be when I was 10? I wanted to be a figure skater, you know. But when I thought about, you know, when I did go to college, I certainly did think about, should I be a business major? Because, you know, that's just a shorter degree and a small, you know, probably more lucrative earlier. But if you were to say, what would you want to be doing that 10 years from now? I would have said, absolutely not. And so I think that you have to look for that place where you feel there's something purposeful and also that you have so much excitement about it, that there's that love of learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit and let's start getting into why you're actually here, which is talking about the work that you do around attention. But I wonder, where did this in particular start? Like, what became the reason that this was the area that you wanted to have your emphasis be on?
In terms of attention deficit disorder is, so I did grow up in a family where I had a brother that was diagnosed, so this was in Michigan a long time ago. And so nobody had really heard of ADHD at that time. So I really grew up with that idea of, knew what ADHD was before most people did. Because my brother's case, you know, he had severe ADHD, I also had ADHD, but I would never have been diagnosed because, again, I was, you know, more conforming and more trying to not get in trouble. But also, I think just that in comparison, it just didn't seem like it was as debilitating. So I grew up knowing exactly what it was. And then by the time I started studying psychology, I was, of course, more interested in it probably than other people. And when I was in graduate school, I did a little research project with a student who was taking a abnormal psychology class that I was teaching. And our question was, can we find people and bring them in and say, what do they think are the benefits of this diagnosis? And everybody had some interesting things to say. And that started off my actual kind of academic engagement with ADHD.
Were you a good student in school?
Yes, I was. I was not a good student until I went to ninth grade. And then I became a pretty great student, actually. And I like to, I always think about that because I really didn't have a lot of pressure to be a good student. But when I got to ninth grade, something happened, which was I just became ambitious and I wasn't motivated. That would have been like too small of a word. I was, when I look back, I almost have the sense that it's almost like certain things, you know, we get our teeth at this age, we hit puberty at this age. I feel like if you don't sort of suppress a person's love of learning that, well, at least for me, ambition just emerged developmentally, and it really carried me through high school with good grades.
What about college?
And then in college, I was a fantastic student, actually.
The reason I ask this is because I think I was kind of the exact opposite. I had fantastic grades pretty much all the way through high school, enough to get me into Berkeley, and it was all downhill from there. I don't know what happened, and I wonder if perhaps you could shed some light on what might have gone wrong here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to exactly what I said about the love of learning. I think that when you focus on getting good grades, then that's not a fun thing to do. And so for me, up until high school, I really was just an indifferent student. I couldn't even tell you what my grades were. And then I actually maybe didn't even have a love of learning for high school, but I had ambition. And so then it became, something that I really wanted for myself. And, I worked really hard for that, and that became, but completely driven from the inside. And so what I believe can happen is that it's so stressful to get good grades all the way from like elementary school to middle school to high school that you might lose that love of learning. And the thing is that I have always loved learning. I would always be reading books on the outside. I read a self-help book once when I was in high school, and I loved it. And I felt like, and I kept reading in that area. And so again, it was enthusiasm. I think maybe what can happen when people become poor students is that they lose that enthusiasm. They lose that love of learning. And, I think the thinking for yourself part, I think that's what can make learning so exciting, is to have all these new ideas.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about this project with a student where you started to look at what might be the benefits of having ADHD. And I wonder, what did you discover were the benefits? And for people who are listening, if they feel that they're in the situation, how can they basically turn what seems like a disadvantage into an advantage?
Yeah, so this is exactly where the education hits the diagnosis, because the student was someone that got really bad grades in my class. But he would come to office hours and he would ask all these questions that were fantastic questions. And he was really engaged with the material, but it absolutely didn't show up in his work. So what he was a bad studier. He just wasn't good at studying, but he was so engaged. Whereas, let's say the other good students, if they came to office hours, they would say, oh, what's on the test on Tuesday, or what's on the test on Thursday? And they weren't, really engaged with the ideas and coming up with new ideas. So when we began to bring people in and say, what do you think the gifts are? One of the things that people would say is that I don't want the right answer. I want to come up with new answers. I want to explore things. And so there are people that tend to want to explore new answers. They want to investigate new answers. They want to discover things. And this is really different from fact-finding and getting the right answer. And this is why you find that, that sometimes when people leave school, they, can be very successful in things that require creativity or innovation. And so those were some of the big ones. Another thing that came up was, people would say, I can't pay attention in class because I'm looking around. And I remember someone said, I looked at someone that seemed really upset, and I just wanted to tell them that, they're wonderful, and I wanted them to feel good about themselves. And so here you have a person who's not paying attention in class, but you see this incredible sensitivity and emotional empathy for other people. And it's such a noble thing. And of course, all of us can imagine so many examples of, job descriptions that they would be great at. So those were the sorts of things we found.
Wow. Well, let's do this. I think this is really interesting, because I think even in my own experience with dealing with this, I found that I could obsessively focus on something if I was interested in it. And if not, my attention would be all over the place.
So you could focus on things that you were interested in.
Yeah, if I was interested in something, I could focus obsessively on it for hours on end. But if not, then, my attention is all over the place.
Exactly. Yeah, so that has to do with the nature of attention. And so it is easy to pay attention to things that we're interested in. And so if you can turn your career into things you're already interested in, in fact, I think that's one of the biggest hacks in life, is to do what you're interested in. That is the biggest brain hack.
Yeah.
And, even in my own career, like I mentioned, I came out to San Francisco because I was doing a postdoc in research. So it's kind of like the Goldilocks, I did research and I was okay at it, but it was hard. And then, so after that, I went into teaching at a liberal arts college. And that was better. It was like, okay, this is a little bit better. But then I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to be teaching the same classes for, decades. And I happened to also, get a book contract. And so I decided to move into writing and my own private practice. And then it was like, okay, there's the sweet spot. And when it's easy to pay attention, then, that's the best formula. That's the best brain hack ever in terms of life success, career success. And as you're saying, it's just easy to do.
we're going to get into specific tactical stuff around attention, but I want to ask you one more question around this. What have you found as a correlation between people who are ADD and deal with things like depression and anxiety?
Those numbers are high, and some research would say between like 50 and 80% of people that have ADHD will have depression and anxiety. And so part of it has to do with, again, this idea that if you have a negative thought, it requires, you know, the prefrontal cortex, our executive functioning, to say, is this a helpful thought or is this an unhelpful thought? And to change those thoughts. In terms of feeling sad or overcome with anxiety, you know, we can regulate those emotions again with our, and this is the deficit of ADHD, is your, you know, the with the prefrontal cortex and kind of being the boss of your brain. And so, you know, and if you look at the treatments for depression and anxiety, they have so much to do with, okay, building, you know, flexible thinking, building the ability to challenge those thoughts and substituting those thoughts or ignoring those thoughts. So yeah, there is a very substantial overlap.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you said the word that I think will end up being the title of the interview. You said being the boss of your brain. So let's talk about how somebody actually becomes the boss of their brain.
Okay. So being the boss of your brain means that you don't accept every thought or feeling or impulse that you have. So for example, let's start with a simple example is, you know, let's say you got, you feel rejected about something and you, and then you start to kind of spiral downwards and, or you're not getting the results that you want and you think, oh, maybe I should just give up. Or you think, this is so much harder than I thought. Well, when you, with ADHD, you know, you tend not to be the boss of your brain and you kind of, you let you run with that or you don't challenge it. So by being the boss of your brain, you could say, well, I give myself a lot of credit because I took a risk. I was brave. I was rejected or I didn't get what I wanted, but look at all that I had. And you begin to say, this is not helpful to think that way. And I'm going to, you know, take my brain forcefully, have it think about something else. And I also call that kind of changing the channel. So if you think about, if you are watching cable TV and if you're scrolling through the channels and you see golf and you don't really like golf, you're not going to sit there and watch a golf game. You're going to just change a channel. Mm-hmm. And being the boss of your brain means you can change the channel on your brain. We all have the capacity to do that.
What is it that causes people to get sort of mired in these spirals where they can't change the channel? Because I've had days when I've tried, and one of the things I realized is like, okay, if I fight this, for some reason, it just perpetuates it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So another thing that you can do is to amplify it, strangely enough. So let's say you're in a spiral and you are disappointed that you wanted some results and you didn't get those results. And you could, so the opposite of challenging it immediately would be to say, okay, I'm going to let myself, whether it's grieve or feel sad. And you can imagine it like a wave. And you can even say, actually, I'm going to imagine like a wave that it's going to get bigger. And as you let that sense of grief or disappointment get bigger, then you say, and like a wave, you know, it can subside. And so you get this practice of intensifying it and then releasing it. Because when you intensify it, now you know, I actually do have some control over this. And it also, you know, can give you some relief to not be just putting the lid on it all the time.
Yeah. So we've talked about it from the standpoint of emotional regulation, which it seems like is a precursor to actually getting shit done. The things that we want to get done. So how do we take these ideas and then apply them to the work that we're doing? So, you know, we live in a world, as you and I were talking about before, where we're navigating basically a landmine of interruption and distractions and people constantly trying to get our attention. So how do you basically navigate this and use all these ideas to be productive and to accomplish the things you want to accomplish?
Mm-hmm. So I think with, you know, one of the things we had mentioned was that I think that all of the technology and temptations that are out there, that in the palm of our hand, you can have global entertainment, you can play video games, you can stream comedies from the 80s, you can do whatever you want. And so I think that part of the answer is to, you know, to recognize, is to be clear that this is kind of like the cigarettes of our generation, because it's actually, our brains did not at all evolve to be able to handle this. And so being able to recognize that multitasking and these distractions, again, this is where it comes back to being the boss of your brain. And so there's a lot of strategies. And I think one of the most helpful can be, what are the consequences of this? And this is how you can motivate yourself is, one of the consequences of spending this much time on social media or streaming videos is that what else could I do with that 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours a day? And so if 3 hours a day, you could achieve all of your fitness goals, all of your health goals. 3 hours a day, you could easily write a book over the course of a year. In 3 hours a day, you could, spend time with the people that you love and care about. And, they won't be here forever, and to really cherish those moments. You could take classes and learn new technologies to grow your own business. You could, there's so much that you can do in 3 hours a day that almost everybody is spending wasting through various distractions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's no doubt. I think to me, the most interesting thing that you brought up was the idea of what are the consequences of this, right? Like, you think about the opportunity cost of spending 2 hours every day on Facebook, and that suddenly makes that time worth a lot more. It's interesting because, Tell Me Ford just came up with a new book called Digital Minimalism, and he said, if you had to pay to use Facebook by the minute, it would really make you reconsider whether that's a good use of your money and your time.
Right. Right. Yes. And so I think, one way you can kind of, work with your brain is you can say, oh, what are the benefits of this time that I'm spending on Instagram, on Facebook? And of course, your brain will have lots of answers. It'll be like, oh, I get to stay connected with people. Or when you're talking about sometimes you spiral down into those mood issues about things in real life. Oh, it kind of numbs me out. But truthfully, that's not the best way to regulate emotion. So there are some benefits, and we don't have to pretend that that's not the case.
Yeah.
But we also have to get real about, I've been wanting to learn this new sport, or I have been wanting to learn some new skills, or I want to spend time with my family, or I have been wanting to, it's New Year's.
Yeah.
Time, and we all have goals. And so those goals happen through time that we invest in them.
Yeah. Well, I think, you and I were talking about this before we hit record here, where I decided, after reading Cal's book that, okay, one of the perfect ways to be a case study for him and also make the interview interesting is to quit social media for 30 days, to just walk away from it and see what else I would do with my time. And it was kind of amazing the projects that I came up with. I was like, okay, I want to learn how to make all these things to eat. I have a, renovation project for my apartment. And it kind of blew my mind that there are all these things that would make our lives interesting if we weren't busy watching other people's lives who we think have lives that are more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's really profound. And I've had a similar experience whenever I've scaled back. I took Facebook off of my cell phone, which means I don't really use it that much. And it was just amazing to me how much more time that I had to, for me, it's like organization. One of the problems with ADHD is you have a hard time organizing your environment. But if you think about all the time you're scrolling through Facebook or Instagram, and if you started, organizing your environment and straightening things up, then every next step in everything you have for a goal for yourself is easier. And if you can find things easier, if you can, if you have prompts, if you write yourself a note with a prompt reminding you what your goals are, you know, you're going to move forward in achieving those goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that to me was one of those things, just like the sheer noise that is created, and you don't really have access to the sound of your own voice or your own thoughts when you are being inundated with everybody else's.
Right. Right. Exactly. And so with so many distractions that, you know, that's what, again, coming back to being the boss of your brain, is realizing how powerful these distractors are for us, mm-hmm. And deciding to make a different decision.
What has your research shown about the impact that all of this has on our social relationships?
Well, I mean, everything that's coming out is negative. And in terms of both, you know, in-person interactions, and, you know, the research was getting headlines recently that, you know, it could, you know, it creates depression because there's, you know, the fear of missing out, and you're seeing people's best lives rather than, you know, real honest, you know, mirrors of what other people are going through. And I think that in terms of mood, I think one of the most important things to know is if you look at what creates happiness, I mean, those things are, you know, social connections, things that boost moods are time in nature. So, you know, getting outside, or things like healthy pleasures, which could be hobbies in terms of, is it a sport that you like to play? Is it, do you like to do arts and crafts? That those are things that create happiness and social connections. And so again, 3 hours a day on, you know, technology is 3 hours a day that you're not getting those healthy mood boosts. Mm-hmm.
And what, I mean, I know that you've also done work around addiction, and it seems like a lot of these tools are, I mean, it doesn't seem like it, we know these tools are all designed to be addictive. I mean, are we going to basically create so much damage in a generation that have grown up on this stuff that we're going to be able to undo it?
I mean, I think it's really scary in the sense that, like, so for example, even, you know, iPhone has a way that you can monitor how much time that you're spending, but that's really, again, it's almost like if this is the cigarettes of our generation, it's actually not really helping because you have to be the one to then turn off those things.
Yeah.
And I do want to say, I do think it is the cigarettes of our generation. And I do think that the, you know, the kind of effort to have you have your iPhone monitor your time on different technologies is not even close to being enough. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that in terms of, you know, I mean, I think you're right. It comes back to helping people to recognize the real costs. Yeah. I mean, so for example, with multitasking, it depletes. You're twice as likely to make a mistake when you're multitasking, and everything's going to take longer to do. And if you do it a lot, it actually depletes your working memory, your attention span. Mm-hmm. So all of these are negatives, and yet they're all a regular part of life. And so it's kind of like getting out at the educational level and at every level, this is not good. What are the benefits of this?
Yeah.
And because even when you list the benefits again, they're not tremendous. And then what are the costs? And the costs are very severe.
Yeah. The costs seem to significantly outweigh the benefits.
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting. What prompted the discussion about our relationships with people, you and I were talking about this, and I recently published a piece based on having seen this video that went viral in Spain. And it's a piece titled "On the Time We Have Left with the People Who Matter Most to Us." And I think the thing that struck me most when I saw that video, they listed all these horrifying statistics about how much time we'll spend watching videos on the internet, how much time we'll spend staring at screens. And all of those were like years. And then they went to, basically they said, based on data that we have statistically, we can calculate how much time you have left with the people who matter most to you. And, you know, they'd have these pairs of people, like two best friends, your mother and son. And the psychologist asked them, would you like to know? And of course, every one of them said yes. And they were horrified by how short of a time it was. They thought they had years when it turned out to be days. when they added up all the time put together.
Wow. I mean, that gives me the chills. It's so true. And I think it's exactly those kinds of maybe, what do you call them? Public service announcements that will wake people up. Because it's so immediately gratifying to numb yourself out with, you know, with all these things, videos. And it's so, you know, again, as you said, designed to be addictive. And we really lose perspective of what matters and what's important. And so it may be that, you know, every time, you know, you get onto social media or you're about to watch, you know, the next episode on Netflix, that you ask yourself, you know, what are the benefits of this? What are the costs of this? What am I not doing? Who am I not talking to? What goals do I have that I'm throwing in the garbage can by doing this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that in my mind, if there's anything that makes sense, it's looking at the opportunity cost, because I think the opportunity cost will convince you that this isn't as valuable as you think it is, and it isn't as worthwhile as you think it is.
And to be honest with you, even asking the benefits, it's actually kind of hard to articulate, isn't it? We all deserve downtime. It's nice to have a little break from the pressures of our life. But after, you know, you're watching like the third episode of Gilmore Girls, what really is the benefit of that? It's not going away. It's going to be there, you know? So I think that even that question, what are the benefits of this? It's hard to sustain an answer to that after a certain amount of time.
What do you think are the responsibilities of the people who create these things? I mean, it seems like basically what has happened is they're now trying to correct course and undo maybe what was unintentional damage.
Right. I think that what they have now is not going to work, where you can have your iPhone report back to you what you're doing, because that's also not telling you what you're doing on Facebook and all the other things. I think, you know, what would be fascinating would be if some of the companies, I don't know how this would work, but like they would send you a text message that would say, what are the benefits of what you're doing right now? What are the costs of what you're doing right now? And so you really had to ask and answer that question, or maybe even like somehow little alerts would show up on the phone that said, do you know that, within 2 hours that you spent on social media, you could have exercised for an hour and prepared a healthy meal rather than, you know, stopping and getting a slice of pizza, or, you know, showing you that all the other goals that you have are what are being compromised, or even just questions that pop up that say, you know, what were your New Year's resolutions? Have you thought about those lately? How's that going? When 10 years from now, how are you going to feel about having watched every episode of Gilmore Girls? Or, you know, so I'm just having a little fun with it. But there, you know, instead of saying, hey, here's what you're doing, because, you know, it's not that motivating, you know, suggesting what are your goals, or you know, what's your role in the galaxy? You know, what is your purpose? And what's your mission statement? Have you thought about your mission statement lately? Because when you began to ask those questions, you're like, oh my God, what am I doing here?
Wow. Well, this has been really, really insightful and thought-provoking. I hope that it will encourage people to really look into potentially ditching some of these things for a while. So I want to finish with one final question, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Well, kind of coming back to what we've just been talking about, this idea that I think of James Hillman has this theory, what he calls the acorn theory, that we are an acorn and our destiny is to become an oak tree. And but it's a long journey to become an oak tree. And, you know, the fulfillment of our potential requires us to say no to lots of wrong paths. There's so many temptations and things that take us off that path. And there's so many complications to becoming that oak tree, which is, you know, what your purpose, that maybe what you were born for, what your destiny was. And so I think that, you know, when people when you can see certain people and you say, wow, they're really living out their destiny. You know, they seem to be right on track. They're living in their jet stream, which is, you know, one of the words that I like to use. You know, they're flying, they're in their interest, and they have fulfilled so much purpose. And, you know, clearly they're enjoying themselves. They're having a lot of fun with it. And, you know, other people are benefiting. So for me, it's kind of this metaphor of, you know, we all start off as an acorn, but how many people really become the oak tree? And that, to me, that's what unmistakable creativity is.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your interests with us. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
I have a website, addisagift.com.
Awesome. Anywhere else?
Well, I have 6 books on Amazon.com. My latest one is Brain Hacks, also The Gift of ADHD, the ADHD workbook for teens. So there's on Amazon.com too.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.